Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Heldick.
When we face a jobs crisis worse than anything we've seen since the Great Depression, it is absolutely unconscionable that this administration would be actively working to kill jobs and deny the American people access to affordable and reliable energy.
We make more money with coal because clean water is free. Clean air is free. Children with asthma are free. Mercury in streams and lakes is free.
Some comments from a public hearing this week in Frankfurt. It was conducted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which has delayed action on 36 coal mining permits because of pollution concerns, even though the permits were green-lighted by the state. It's an issue that pits environmental groups concerned about the dumping of coal waste against coal mining interests, including miners and their families who say they need the work and the mines would provide in order to survive. Here to talk about it are Bill Estep of the Lexington Herald Leader and WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Hello.
Bill, you attended the hearing, but first there were what you described as dueling rallies. One was in support of the coal industry, the other in support of increased environmental regulations. Describe the scene and tone of those rallies.
Well, this was in downtown Frankfurt on the plaza adjacent to the Civic Center there in Frankfurt. There were several hundred people there in support of coal, the pro-coal rally. And I couldn't estimate. There were probably 800 to 1,000. Some of them were bused in from the hazard area. They were brought down from Alpha Naturalis, just several other companies. Some bused in from Louisville. Wayne Supply brought in a bus or a busload of folks. So it was a pretty noisy rally. There were a lot of public officials who spoke there. That started about 5:30. About 100 yards away, 200 yards away, in the Capitol Plaza Hotel, in a meeting room there, the environmentalists had a press conference, and they had brought several folks, and they talked about studies that indicate, health effects and environmental damage from surface mining. There were about 75, maybe 100 people there. That was a pretty low-key event. It was not nearly as noisy as the other one. Then both sides went from there to the meeting that started at 7, on the hearings on the coal permits.
I see. Well, we just heard a clip of two speakers from the public hearing that followed the two rallies. Erica, give us some background on why there was a hearing.
Well, there's a hearing because basically over the past 2 years, there have been 36 permits. They're NPDES permits, which is National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits. It's basically a coal mine needs these permits in order to discharge, effluent waste into waters and the state had green-lighted these permits, as you said before. And the EPA sent letters basically saying that they objected to the permits because the Division of Water had failed to conduct an adequate, reasonable potential analysis. So they were basically saying that they were curious as to why the Division of Water hadn't conducted what they thought was a good analysis. And they kind of concluded in their objection letters that that could be because the environmental impact would be, would be such that the permit wouldn't be granted otherwise. That was pretty much the case for all 36 permits. And the state had been kind of angling for a while to get some public hearings here, and the EPA finally answered that call.
So what kinds of concerns were brought up during the hearing? There were quite a few speakers, right?
Yeah, I don't know, Bill. I guess were you at the Pikeville one as well?
I was not the one at Pikeville. I just went to Frankfurt. I had another assignment on Thursday. At the one in Frankfurt, I didn't get to stay for all of it because of a deadline situation. It was from 7 to 11. I did talk to the EPA officials, who said that there were 70 people scheduled to speak, and then some other folks who had been allowed to sign up at the door. And it lasted. I got back down there about 10:30 to check, and it was over by then. But there were between 75 and 100 speakers there that night. And there was a lot of the people who were allowed to go first were the public officials from Kentucky, legislators, some county judges from coal counties. There was a lot of criticism of the EPA, rather, I would say, a lot of requests for them to back away from these objections.
I thought it was interesting, too. There were 21 elected officials, I think, and only one, Joni Jenkins from Louisville, spoke
right
in favor of the EPA.
And she talked about the problems. I mean, it affects, coal is an issue there because of fly ash. She said she has constituents who live across from a fly ash facility, and that it gets on their houses and that sort of thing. So, you know, coal, it affects a lot of different parts of the state in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I thought, too, I mean, a lot of the arguments we heard, you know, at least in my opinion, it was very predictable, you know, and I'd say the EPA, the EPA knew exactly what they were going to hear before they heard it. You know, we heard a lot of, from one side, we heard a lot of talk about jobs, a lot of sort of lampooning the Obama administration, you know, insinuating that he wasn't going to win Kentucky anyway. And so that was why he was targeting Kentucky.
Well, no, several speakers said just flat out that the reason, and in fact, the reason it's come to that point is because EPA initially issued this guidance on it's what started this whole thing in April 2010 was EPA issued essentially a new guidance as to how it would judge whether to approve surface mine permits, and they put in a new standard on conductivity, which is a measure of the potential contamination in water. And so they've been using that standard to judge permits that they didn't use before, and. So the state has requested hearings on some of those permits, but the reason it's gotten to this point is because there was a change in the way EPA started judging the permits.
Yeah, and I mean, and EPA hasn't, you know, I think we can say EPA hasn't really helped its case with the conductivity, and they have issued, you know, several documents laying out in very scientific language why they think this is a concern, why they think it's worthy looking at, but they're just looking at conductivity right now in West Virginia and Kentucky, which is because that was where that was the region they studied, and that was the region they determined that conductivity was a valid measure under these conditions.
Well, they initially issued that guidance that I started to say a minute ago for six states for covering central Appalachia. Now they've since, in the final guidance, they've backed that down just to eastern Kentucky and West Virginia. And that has helped, you know, that sort of added to the perception that they're targeting this area because, you know, both of those states did not vote for Obama in 2008, will not vote for him this time. So that, whereas some other states that are considered battleground states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, others were dropped out of that final consideration. So that's kind of led to some thinking among the opponents here that this is a political underpinning for all this.
We're talking with Bill Estep of the Lexington Herald Leader and WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson about EPA hearings this week into some coal mining permits that has held up. Now, what happens next in this process? Is it up to the EPA to let these go forward or not?
Yeah, well, the EPA basically now, the comment period, people can submit written comments for another, I think, week or so. And then basically the EPA will either affirm their objections. They'll say, yeah, we were right. We still have these objections. They could alter them. They could say, well, it changed a little bit. Or they could say, oh, forget it. You know, we've gotten over our objections.
And as the process goes, if they don't withdraw their objections and the state does not, you know, revise the permits in accordance with EPA's objections, then the authority to issue those permits will pass to EPA. Kentucky will lose primacy over those particular permits.
Yeah, which, I mean, is a real concern, you know, I would think, in the coal industry, because Kentucky has kind of always been a little bit more lenient, you know, than the federal government with these kind of things.
It's also worth saying here that these permits are I mean, and EPA officials pointed out at the hearing the other night, there have been about 2,500 permits for new expanded operation, coal mining operations issued under another permitting scheme called a general permit. These are individual discharge permits under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act that a surface mine has to get to emit or discharge pollutants into streams. So these 36 are in some ways are pretty small. What the environmentalists see is a drop in the bucket. They feel like the industry is kind of crying wolf over what the potential economic impact of these are. Although Alpha Natural Resources just announced today that they're going to lay off something like 400 people in eastern Kentucky, and they cited regulatory uncertainties as part of the reason for that, along with the warm winter, competition from Wyoming coal, some other things. So,
and actually, Bill, if you hold on a sec, we have a quote here from Ted Pyle, who is the spokesman from Alpha Natural Resources.
Okay.
Well, we're really seeing a fundamental shift in the market for coal. Electric utilities are turning more and more to cheap and abundant natural gas, and we're also seeing an onslaught of regulations from Washington that would require these electric utilities to make huge expenditures on equipment, and it's causing them to shut down their coal-fired power plants. And on top of that, we've had an exceptionally mild winter where power consumption was way down. So ultimately this year, coal use for electricity generation is expected to be at its lowest level in 20 years.
And one of the factors that I thought was interesting about that, I mean, not only is it kind of a bunch of factors all coming together that make things not great for coal, but one of the reasons Kentucky, and particularly these mines in eastern Kentucky, are being affected is because they produce thermal coal,
right,
which, you know, the market is down for. There are mines in West Virginia that Alpha is running that are metallurgical coal mines where the coal is really going to make steel. And those,
right,
those aren't doing great, but there is more demand for metallurgical coal, especially overseas.
Right.
Let's wrap it up with just a little time left before we have a montage of some of the folks who spoke at the Frankfurt hearing. But just looking at a big picture question for both of you, and I'll start with you, Erica. What do you think was going to happen to eastern Kentucky and the state as a whole as the coal industry keeps shrinking?
Well, I mean, I don't know, and Bill, you're over there, and I'm not. But I moved here from West Virginia, and it's something that I think everyone is struggling with. You know, I know nonprofits are starting to talk about transition. It's something that we've seen a little bit of movement on a state level to try to stimulate the economy down there with something other than natural resources. But, you know, not too much has picked up right now, I'd say. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. Energy Information Administration has that over the next decade or so that there's going to be a really significant drop in coal production from Central Appalachia, which is primarily West Virginia and eastern Kentucky. And they cite a lot of different factors in that, natural gas, rising production costs. I mean, it's becoming more expensive to get the coal out of eastern Kentucky by surface mining methods. A lot of different factors. Regulation or uncertainties over regulation certainly plays some role in that, but it's hard to kind of factor out exactly how much. The bottom line is that they're looking at a real drop in production. A lot of people over there are concerned about it. I talked with a miner from Hazard at the meeting in Frankfurt the other night. He was there with his wife and two daughters, and he got choked up. He got emotional talking about what would happen if he lost his job. He says there's nothing else there. And I think that's true. There are very few things at this point that would replace these coal mining jobs in eastern Kentucky that are being lost now and going to be lost. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of concern in the region about what's going to happen. They've been trying for 20 years using coal severance money to try to diversify the economy, and frankly, that hasn't it hasn't gotten to the point where it would replace coal just yet.
Right.
So the I guess the bottom line is just a lot of uncertainty.
Thanks to Bill Estep of the Lexington Herald Leader and WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson. We're going to take you out now with some comments from the public hearing in Frankfurt Tuesday night.
First, I would like to welcome the Environmental Protection Agency to a coal-producing state.
I know there is no my water separate from your water. What's in your water is in my water. When our state agencies fail to enforce federal laws to safeguard our water, be it from the coal mine or the coal ash dump, it impacts our water and it impacts our health.
There's not a coal miner, coal operator, or anyone in here who wants dirty water. That's not what this is about. It's never been about that.
Let my people go back to work, because when you free those permits, you free my people.
We are asking the EPA to reaffirm its objections to all 36 permits.
Coal is mined in Kentucky in an environmentally responsible way. Everything we do here is legal until you change the rules.
You all have a president in Washington that has targeted coal since day one.
It's been about a president who has decided to punish a state that didn't vote for him in 2010. And it's about a state that ain't gonna vote for him this year.
Would you be taking this position, singling out Kentucky, if it were a battleground state like Ohio and Illinois? No, you wouldn't. They are being penalized.
Solar energy is cheaper than coal, a lot cheaper, when investors have to pay for the damage they do. Let the EPA do its work protecting our land and our water.
The Middle Fork watershed has no municipal sewers whatsoever. There is mass raw sewage emptying into the Middle Fork. And you're concerned about 37 acres and two bench ponds.
I've done extensive water testing downstream of surface mines in eastern Kentucky, and have seen firsthand the water quality damage the surface mines can do.
Time and again, the EPA has tried to bypass the Congress and weaken state authority. And they make no secret of this administration's intentions to shut down Kentucky coal.
At a time when I should be excited about our future, I am full of concern and uncertainty because our future is bleak because of the regulatory ambush on the coal industry by the EPA.
We are fortunate that the Environmental Protection Agency has stepped in to protect our water quality and our public health when our own state government has systematically failed in that regard.
And I bring to you, EPA, a message, and that message is you've gone too far, and you know you have.
Some comments from an EPA hearing Tuesday evening in Frankfort on 36 coal mining permits in Kentucky. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, budget hearings continue here in Louisville as the Metro Council continues to sift through Mayor Greg Fisher's proposed spending plan. And joining us to talk about it briefly is WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey. Philip, welcome back.
Hey, Rick.
So the we've heard from, where are we now? The public has actually had a chance now to start to weigh in on this, right?
Yeah, initially at the beginning of the week is when City CFO Steve Rowland testified before the Metro Council. But earlier this week as well, the public had a chance to chime in on the mayor's spending plan. You saw, I mean, the house was packed, and mostly teenagers from Project One, which is Charles King's program, which deals with summer youth jobs. They were filling not only the council chambers, but the overflow room as well. So you saw a lot of people who were there, and mainly the list of people were people from external agencies and nonprofit groups, which wanted to sort of chime in and have their voices heard in regards to spending in the Metro budget. You've seen some changes to certain organizations, certain arts groups like the Louisville Ballet. I think as Aaron Keene has reported, the Louisville Ballet had an 80% cut in city funding. Other organizations like the Center for Women and Families, they saw their funding once again reduced by the mayor by about 44%. Now, traditionally, the council adds money back in before they pass the final budget. There's a question of whether how lean the budget is, if the council can find some additional funds and how to get those in for these groups. But Charles King in particular, who's the president and CEO of Project One, which is a summer jobs program for 13 to 15-year-olds, he says that the funding has gone from $80,000 to zero. So he was pretty upset about that. So you saw a lot of people just come up and say and argue and petition the council why their programs are important, who their programs help, and why the funding is needed.
And the city coming under some criticism from one speaker, you reported criticizing the mayor, I guess, for giving $500,000 to a group of investors for the Whiskey Row project.
Yeah, a resident from the Clifton neighborhood who showed up, he addressed, David Sangster's his name, he addressed the council and basically saying that he was upset with the idea of giving $500,000 towards restoring the historic buildings along Main Street known as Whiskey Row. That's obviously been an issue for a number of years now when preservationists petitioned the mayor and the council to swipe these buildings back from developer Todd Blue and to save them and to salvage them. The mayor's proposed the idea of funding and creating this loan program, matching money with that has been matched by wealthier contributors. The group of wealthy investors have already gotten a $1.5 million forgivable loan. So some council members, Councilman Kelly Downer, Councilman Jerry Miller, and Councilwoman Mary Woolridge, which is a bipartisan group, they've objected to this $500,000, even going as far as to say that they may vote against the entire budget if that $500,000 is included. So you heard a speaker actually go up there, which was pretty rare, and saying who didn't ask for money. Usually when you have people go up to the Metro Council in these addresses, they want more money. This person was like, no, I'm not here to ask for money. I actually don't want you to spend.
So let's go through the process here. The council will add or take away money from Fisher's proposal and then pass its own budget. Now, does the mayor have line item veto power on the budget?
I don't believe the mayor has line item vetoes as some other executives do. But what we'll see over the next few weeks is different department heads and different agencies coming forward and then giving their review, the police department, fire department, health department, Metro Animal Services, et cetera, will come and sort of give their 2 cents on what how they're running their departments. And then you're right, you'll see the council really go over how do we put in these funds here, how do we help this group, who's going to get money, who's not. Like I said, the council, last year the Metro Council added about $500,000 extra to certain funding for external agencies. So we may see that again. I've never seen in Metro's history the mayor veto any whether line item or line item or veto any parts of the budget in particular, veto the budget altogether. It's unlikely that'll happen again this year if the council finds some additional ways to fund some organizations, unless something comes to a head, which it doesn't look like right now it will, but there's plenty of weeks left.
So what's our timetable? We've got several weeks more of hearings?
Well, you're going to the budget has to be passed by law by June 30th. Once June 30th happens, then we have a situation where we will see the budget passed and go from there. But it's likely that there's not going to be a problem with that. But we will see that come down probably in the next two weeks. I know the council is anticipating between June 20th and June 28th to have a budget actually passed.
All right. Philip M. Bailey is WFPL's political editor. Philip, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
I'm going to turn now to WFPL News Director Gabe Bullard and Devin Katayama from the WFPL Newsroom to talk about some other issues and developments going on around the metro. Big news this week in local media, Gabe. Courier-Journal sports columnist Eric Crawford and Rick Bozich headed over to WDRB-TV.
Yeah, they've started as well. They're working right now. In fact, when WDRB got back on cable, the first thing I saw was Eric Crawford giving some analysis on television. Yeah. So Eric Crawford, he's working now. He's writing some columns. Mm. And Rick Bozich is headed to New York for the Belmont, if he's not there already.
So like all of us media outlets, we're not just TV and radio anymore. We're multi-platform, as we like to call it. So they've, WDRB has a big web presence. So you talked to Eric about, he's been there for a long time. His dad was at the Courier-Journal, mm-hmm. Byron Crawford, for years. Rick Bozich has been there for over 30 years.
Yeah.
And you talked to Eric about why he jumped.
Yeah, yeah. Here's what Eric said about why he would go over to TV.
Well, neither of us really was looking, and we were called over to WDRB after the NCAA tournament kind of calmed down, and we thought maybe they wanted to talk to us about coming on once a week or something, and we sat down, and they basically pitched that we want you to think about a career move, and we both left the building shocked, and then over the next month or so, it was just a process of thinking and talking and plotting, and I really, until even a week and a half before it was done, really was still doubtful that it would get done. But they really made a commitment, and we were really impressed.
And here's why he said they actually ended up making that jump.
There's also just this basic feeling, at least on our part, of instability. We saw people who we thought were very important journalists as there are in this city, who were bought out. We saw people leaving, and you just have to sit and wonder. We looked at a situation at USA Today where veteran people who are very talented were having to reapply for jobs, and that level of uncertainty kind of made us perk up a little more when an opportunity to do something different came along.
So this is a pretty big blow to the Courier-Journal, since sports are such a big part of news organizations, and WDRB was able to pretty much just hire some of the best sports reporters in the state, or really buy some of the best coverage in the state. And it's a pretty sensitive time for the Courier that all this is happening. The Courier just put up its paywall. You can look at 20 articles for free every month. If you're a subscriber, you can keep looking, or you can pay $13 to get unlimited access to the website. But sports can really drive people online. You hear a lot of people talking about this. And the CJ's working to hire more columnists. They had a web chat yesterday with the paper's publisher and the head of news, and both said they've already seen some applications rolling in. They're going to be looking at them. But it's still a hit at a time of some instability and uncertainty.
Before we run out of time, WDRB in the news for another reason this mm-hmm. week, because their contract with Time Warner Cable expired and no agreement was reached.
Yeah, this happened last week. We've seen these deals go down to the wire before. Essentially, a cable company pays TV stations to rebroadcast the content. They get the local content, and they get these national Fox shows, the sitcoms, the dramas, all that. So in the past, we've seen Insight negotiating with the local channels, and it comes down to the wire, and you see, normally a notice on the channel that says Dish Network or Insight or so-and-so is – they want too much money, or they won't give us enough money, and we might go off the air. TV stations always use their airwaves for that, pretty much to give them a little bit of a leg up in negotiations. This is the first time we saw it go all the way, when mm-hmm. Time Warner actually pulled WDRB. A deal was reached about a week later, but Bill Lamb, I talked to him, and he said, really, he thinks they're sending a message to the other stations, showing that they're willing to go all the way to the wire, that they're willing to pull the plug on local channels. But he says that he thinks they sent a message back to Time Warner saying that really they're not going to put up with it, that just because they get pulled and lose what was half the audience for WDRB doesn't mean they'll just roll over and take whatever offer is left on the table.
Now, Time Warner purchased Insight, and now is there a new agreement with the city for the franchise?
There's a bridge agreement, and those negotiations with the city are starting. I talked with the mayor's office about this yesterday, and right now the mayor's office is starting to do what's called a needs assessment, which is a necessary part of these negotiations, where they look into what they get now from the franchise agreement and what they may want to get in the future. The big disagreements with Insight when the city had was renegotiating this was essentially free service to school buildings and government buildings. And that's something that is being assessed right now if they need it. They should have that in a couple months and negotiations will start. This Time Warner is a tougher negotiator. They're a bigger company. They have teams of lawyers as well, but more money, more resources to negotiate than Insight did. And I asked the mayor's office if they were concerned about that. They said they're going in optimistic. Mm-hmm. I talked to Bill Lamb about it, what he thought the city may think going in, and he said he didn't want to really give too much analysis on it, but one thing he could say is that the city holds a lot of cards here still. The city, you know, is the one ultimately giving out this contract, so there's more at stake for Time Warner for not negotiating an agreeable compromise for both parties than there is when Time Warner works with a channel.
All right, Gabe Boulder, thank you very much. We're going to turn to Devin Katayama, who covers education and other issues for WFPL. And Devin, you've been reporting this week on a finalist in place to replace Dr. Stephen Dashner at the Greater Clark County School System.
Yeah, Dr. Andrew Mellon has been named. He's out of Valparaiso Community Schools in Indiana, and he was chosen from a pool of 17, what the district board president said, a national pool of 17 individuals, and they were going through a couple rounds of interviews. They weren't going to name any of the candidates, any of the finalists, except for the final candidate that agreed to the contract, which will be $170,000 base salary. Now, a big reason for getting a new superintendent was the high salary, $225,000, that current superintendent Stephen Dashner is receiving. So he will be making significantly less, but he will need to do the same amount show the same results. Dashner was seeing a lot of positive results. Last year, Greater Clark County Schools met all of its No Child Left Behind goals as a district, which is very difficult, as most people know. And I asked Dr. Mellon earlier this week how he plans on addressing the continuing the achievement.
They've shown tremendous growth, and that is something to be honored. And I think what I see, the effort just needs to be continued, and I think that some discussion about systematic approaches that would impact the entire district. In other words, there are programs that certain buildings are doing that are being very successful for that building, but those same program is not necessarily in other buildings as well.
Now, he talked, he was very careful when he was talking to me this week. And then in the public forum yesterday, he didn't talk about huge sweeping changes. I think that's a lot, partly because he still needs to get introduced to the district, meet people, and remember that he still needs to be approved by the district's board. That'll happen next Monday. They'll make a vote on that. But he did talk a lot about individualized instruction, finding where students were, which is where a lot of the common standards are going in education these days anyway.
Just a few seconds left. Does it appear that his appointment will win school board approval?
There are a couple board members who say they will not vote for him, partly because of the way the district has been doing the hiring process. The quick pace is what Becky Christensen was telling me yesterday. But it does seem like that there is support on the board for his approval.
All right, Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us. Devin also conducted an interview with Matthew Tully. In 2009, Indianapolis Star columnist Matthew Tully began writing articles about, is Emanuel High School, am I pronouncing that correct?
Yep, that's right.
Emanuel High School in Indianapolis. It's one of the lowest performing schools in the state. Tully has now written a book about his experience. It's called Searching for Hope, Life at a Failing School in the Heart of America. Devin spoke with Tully, who says he was granted nearly unlimited access to the campus for a year.
I saw everything, and I mean, they said, come on in, you know, and they didn't follow me around, they didn't tell me where I could be or I couldn't be, you know, and everyone got real used to me, so I think I really was able to see in a more honest way what was going on there.
In your book, you talk a lot about the great things that you see in the school. Spencer Lloyd, the choir teacher, a lot of teachers that just put in extra effort to make sure their students are achieving in school, but also sometimes achieving out in real life. And then you also sit in some classrooms that the teacher seems indifferent. They don't really put in that effort. They don't even seem to care sometimes. What kind of range did you see with the teachers, and how do you determine at this point, now that you've gone through this, what makes a good teacher?
Sure. I don't know that I could have seen a wider range than I did. This wasn't uncommon, but in one particular classroom, there were 18 students, and I counted 4 were relatively paying attention, and the other 14 were either sleeping, texting, or were completely turned away from the teacher having conversations, and that was routine. So I'm smart enough to know that's a bad teacher. there's all those teachers in the middle, though, but it's kind of hard for me to know. Are all these middle teachers, are they good teachers? I think that's why it's so important that we see, how they compare when it comes to test scores and other things to other teachers to get a sense of who's really moving the needle among their students. It's a difficult thing. It's a challenging thing to determine who is a good teacher.
You talk a lot about some of the effects of the programs outside of the common classes that people generally think of when they think of student achievement. For example, you talk a lot about the choir. You talk a lot about some of the sports, the after-school activities that might be lacking. You even have a chapter on school spirit. How important are the activities and the non-general classes to a school? And did you see that as being something that education systems should give more weight to?
Yeah, it's a huge concern that I have as we focus more and more on testing and more and more on certain core subjects, which I'm not saying that's not important, but you do worry about what that's going to mean for arts programs and sports programs and music programs. And for instance, at Manual High School, there's a welding program. This is a crucially important program to keeping certain kids in the school. I mean, time and again, I met kids who said, boy, if not for Jason Wiley's welding class, I would have dropped out 2 years ago. It's the only reason I keep coming back. I heard that among choir students, music students. Not to mention school can't just be about, math and science. There has to be more to a school. When you go to a really good, vibrant school, there's a culture there. There's an excitement there. There's a level of pride there.
There's one part in the book when you talk about a student, Brent Jones, who essentially lost his identity when he was younger.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain a little bit about what that situation was?
Yeah, Brent was born in 1991. His mom was was addicted to drugs and was a prostitute at the time, and essentially gave him up to a friend that she sort of knew with the idea that they would officially do an adoption down the road. It never happened, and his birth mom kind of disappeared. And the years went by, and Brent moved from Florida into Indiana with the woman who raised him, and didn't have his birth certificate, didn't have his mom's any way to reach his birth mom, and it was something that really honestly didn't cause any problems until he got older and wanted to get a job and wanted to go to college and wanted to get a driver's license, all these things that you just can't do without a birth certificate to prove your identity. Just to make a long story short, through some research, a librarian at the Star and myself were able to find his birth mom, get his birth certificate, help him get into college and have, the opportunity that he deserved. And I use that story as an example of kind of these huge obstacles that so many kids in schools like Manual have standing in their way, and more has to be done. I mean, not to criticize, but there were a long list of teachers, administrators in a number of schools that he'd gone to over the years, and it kind of stuns me that no one called their congressman or called the social service agency to figure out what could be done. They kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, that stinks.
That's Matthew Tully speaking with WFPL's Devin Katayama. Tully is a political columnist for the Indianapolis Star and the author of Searching for Hope, Life at a Failing School in the Heart of America. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, there's some stunning news today from Belmont Park. I'll have another. Triple Crown contender will not run in tomorrow's Belmont Stakes. Joining us from Belmont Park with the latest is Ed DeRosa of the racing information service, Brisnet.com. Ed, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Wish some happier news to discuss, though.
Yeah, it's very disappointing. Now, trainer Doug O'Neill, I think, held a press conference a little earlier, and you attended that. What did he have to say?
Well, Doug just explained the nature of the injury, which is a tendon injury, not life-threatening, not critical in any way, but certainly one that you would not want to run any horse in, let alone a race as demanding as the Belmont Stakes. So they've decided to scratch. And beyond that, they also said that they have retired the horse from racing altogether. It's the type of injury that will take a half a year just to recover from, to get to the point where he'd even be able to be in training again. So you're talking maybe 9 months to get back to the races. And as a horse who won the Kentucky Derby, there's really not much more you can accomplish in the sport of kings. So he's heading to the breeding shed in 2013.
I know this is obviously very disappointing news for I Don't Have Another's connections. I know they had really pulled out all the stops in preparation for this race.
Yeah, Jenny Reese of the Courier-Journal wrote a great article about all that owner J. Paul Redham had done to accommodate Doug O'Neill's staff and everyone surrounding the horse. And, you know, fans as well as the connection to the horse, Belmont Park was expecting about 100,000 people, a lot of whom had traveled to the New York area for the race, myself included. You know, you hear a lot about people investing themselves in horse racing, and that extends to everyone involved, from the fans to the horse players to the connections of the horse. A lot of long faces here at Belmont Park today. People are really disappointed. They were hoping to, you know, even if not see history, just be a part of the scene that is when the Triple Crown's on the line. It's a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll get to experience it sometime soon.
That leaves 11 horses in the Belmont field, and of course, I Have Another was the 4-5 favorite. I assume Dullahan, which was the second betting favorite, will now move up.
Yeah, I would think he'll be the favorite. Maybe Union Rags. He still has his supporters, despite the dull effort in the Derby, or at least an effort people weren't expecting, given that he was the second choice. But I would say either one of those two will be the favorite. And then Bob Baffert has Painter, who is owned by the same person who owns Bodemeister, so I'd expect he'll probably be the third choice. So still a solid group, but definitely a lot of wind out of the sails with all of another out.
I know people are just involved with the sport of racing, which has been struggling. We're really looking forward to, you know, seeing a possible Triple Crown winner. What would this have meant to the sport?
You know, I'm a big proponent of, it's not so much him winning the race that is so vital to the sport, but just getting to this point where you have a horse in the gate with the chance. I'm the type that doesn't think there'd be a flash mob showing up at Churchill Downs on Sunday if a horse won the Triple Crown on Saturday, but I definitely do think it's the type of race and event that gets people to pay attention, and maybe they go to the track on Saturday to watch the Belmont, whereas they wouldn't have before. So in terms of getting new fans and getting people excited about racing, having this shot is really important to thoroughbred racing, and missing out on it, I'd say, is definitely a blow. Win or lose, it would have been great to have a healthy horse in the gate. Certainly can't begrudge him for taking out a horse who's not 100%, but it's definitely going to hurt interest in racing for the summer.
Ed DeRosa joining us from Belmont Park in New York. Well, I Have Another has been scratched from tomorrow's Belmont Stakes due to injury. Ed, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this, of course, is the segment of the program we dedicate to the arts. The annual Flyover Film Festival is this weekend in Louisville, and WFPL's Aaron Keene is here not only to talk about that, but to introduce two participants in the festival. Hi, Aaron.
Thanks, Rick. I'm here with Martha Stevens, the writer and director of Pilgrim Song, and Timothy Morton, who's a Louisville actor who also plays the lead, James, in the film. Welcome to Louisville, Martha.
Thank you for having us.
So the film is making its Kentucky debut in the Flyover Film Festival tonight at the Speed Art Museum for folks who are planning on attending the festival. And it's kind of special because the film is also set in Kentucky, right? Okay, tell us a little bit about the story of the film.
Yeah, the first 15 minutes of the film was actually set and shot in Louisville. So and then the rest of it takes place in more of eastern Kentucky in the wilds on the Sheltowee Trace Trail. Which is kind of, it runs from Moorhead, Kentucky, down to the border of Tennessee.
And so Pilgrim Song is a road movie that's off-road, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I like to think of it as a 1970s road movie, but on foot.
Thanks. And you play James, the hero. So what is James on the road for? What is he searching for?
He's searching for something that makes sense for him. I mean, he's been laid off of his job, so he's kind of has loose ends that he's trying to find some sort of idea of. I'm not really good at describing it because it's very.
Yeah, he's been laid off from his job, and he has a long-term girlfriend of about 8 years who he's sort of feeling not a lot for as of late. And he decides to take his time off in the summer and go on this trail and do a little soul searching. And along the way, he encounters a few interesting characters and gets taken in by this father and son duo who are very needy of attention. They've been recently left by the mother and they need someone to talk to. And he's like the reluctant companion of these two characters who are really great, I think.
This is sort of a Men Adrift kind of story.
Yeah, it's totally a buddy movie, a somber buddy movie set in Appalachia.
A somber buddy movie. I think that's a new genre, maybe. Well, so and you grew up in the foothills outside of Ashland, Kentucky?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Greenup County, Kentucky, which is the next county from Boyd, which is where Ashland is. Yeah.
And so there's a distinct regionalism in your work. Passenger Pigeons was your last film, and it was also set in Appalachia and eastern Kentucky. Why is it important to you as a filmmaker to set your films and write these stories in the particular part of the world where you grew up?
I think that the common thing is to write what you know and to write from a place that means something to you. And I grew up with a lot of like respect for where I'm from because my family, they were true blue Kentuckians, you know, and we love where we're from, flaws and all. And so I think there's just something interesting about it that doesn't get seen on screen a lot unless it's in a negative way, unfortunately.
So. Well, what is the, is there sort of an overarching story of Appalachia that you're trying to tell through your body of work?
I think it's kind of like, I want to capture a moment in time, and I want to capture Appalachia is like ever changing, and the sort of dying culture of what Appalachia, the parts of Appalachia that I really love, I'm trying to capture them in film before they're gone a little bit.
Can you say a little more about that? What are some of the parts that are dying off that you're trying to?
I think because of sadly drugs and some other nastiness like that. Yeah, there's just the whimsiness, the beauty. It's being ignored because of all the more devastating factors, and there's just like a dying culture. I it's hard to explain. There's like a pride in your work, a good work ethic, that sort of thing. That's I feel like is crumbling a little bit. You might not have a lot of money, or you may be poor, or you're not educated, but you take pride in what you do and who you are. And I'm sad that I feel like that's like a fleeting thing now.
Well, and Appalachia is also marked like a lot of rural areas by an outward migration, the brain drain, as they call it.
Definitely.
You know? But you live in Charleston, West Virginia. And how is that being a filmmaker living in West Virginia? And Tim, I'd ask you the same about being an actor living in Louisville. I think that, you know, the story that everybody knows is you come from somewhere and then you go to Hollywood to make it, or you go to New York to make it. But, you know, technology and access, what is that doing for creating a sort of the artistic class in the flyover states?
Well, first of all, I don't make a living off of acting, so it's not like, you know, if I went to LA and I was making it big, then I would be making it big and I'd have a lot of money. That'd be a huge difference in the lifestyle that I've actually got, which is that I'm living almost entirely off of a credit card right now. And I do acting jobs here and there, but the lifestyle basically is kind of reckless and not completely thought out.
Yeah, and I don't make a living off making movies. I substitute teach and work at a health food store part-time to make ends meet. And I don't want to live in New York or Los Angeles because I have so many friends who do, and it seems like what happens is they work on movies and they work on movies and they work on movies and they have to pay rent, and then they never have time for their own projects. And there's something just mind-clearing about getting to live in the place where I want to write, the place where I want to set movies, and live a humble little life and write my own scripts. And, you know, I go to film festivals and the question's always, where are you based out of? Which I find that question just silly, period. And I'm like, West Virginia. And I get a little laugh or a little, interesting. But I don't care what people think. Who cares? Like, I love where I'm from, and I love the people there. So
there's a difference in the question, too, between where are you based and where are you from, that people aren't interested in where you're from. They just want to know where your office is or where they can come pitch you an idea, maybe.
Right.
Ira Deutschman, who is the head of the film studies at Columbia, said that there's this new, how did he call it, the artisanal class of filmmaker that's rising up, sort of. Now that technology has made the equipment, you know, relatively affordable, that there used to be, you had people who made home movies for fun, and you had people whose goal was to break into the studio system and, you know, get bigger budgets, get bigger audiences, and really sort of make it. But now there's this sort of interesting middle class of artists who can live in West Virginia, live where they work and where they want to set their films, and create art that is seen in festivals like Flyover.
There's a few of us. I think more often than not, people do live in New York and LA, but the few of us that are doing this, I hope that eventually we can still live in West Virginia and make mainstream movies and make ourselves money and not have to, like, go out to LA. You know, that's my dream.
So. Well, it gives actors like Tim also access to filmmakers who are making work in the backyard, so to speak. Are you working on Martha's new project also?
Not directly or formally, but we've talked about it before.
Yeah, I just finished the script. So it's in such like a premature stage. I went out location scouting in West Virginia this week because there's just something empowering about actually setting out to do something that makes me believe you are going to make this, even if I don't have the money to make it yet or anything. But it's always location scouting first, then casting. But I like to use the same people. I kind of have a core group of actors that I turn to that I'm comfortable with, and I think they fit the mood and the tone of the story.
So clear your schedule, Tim. I'm kidding. I don't know. So the Flyover Film Festival, this Pilgrim Song debuted in South by Southwest this year and is sort of making the festival circuit. It's been in Baltimore, Little Rock, North Carolina, South Carolina, Brazil also.
Yeah, we won a prize in Brazil. We're big in Brazil.
Nice.
That's what I heard. Was it the best director, right?
Yeah.
Hey.
Congratulations.
Yes. So,
Oxford American was the prize we won in.
Yeah, we just won a prize at the Little Rock Film Festival last weekend. The Oxford American magazine picked us as the best Southern film of the fest and gave us some money. So
money is good.
Money is
good.
Rare and good.
Well, so what do the film festivals do for the life of the film? Awards, obviously awesome. Is this a step towards securing a distribution deal? How do these function in the life of the film?
You get exposure, networking, as much as networking makes me want to roll my eyes. networking, you know, you never know. You could screen your film and it could really speak to somebody, and they might have a hefty bank account and say, I'd really like to help you make your next movie. That's kind of a pipe dream, but it's a pipe dream I hold on to nonetheless. So what about you, Tim, as an actor? What did they do?
A lot of festivals, you know, have, you know, a lot of, they take care of filmmakers by have free drinks and
we get fed for the weekend
food and put you up in hotels occasionally but I mean, I think that it's exciting to go to film festivals because you can watch a movie and then you can talk to the director or the an actor in it or something like that. I mean, there are a few film festivals that don't attract the filmmakers themselves, but the festivals that do are the ones that I most like to go to, because you can actually start a dialogue with and get to know what the other filmmakers' process is and get to know them you know, stay up late and drink beer and party with them as well. But
yeah.
And I think Flyover has done a good job of
they brought everybody
they've in. Brought in pretty much, yeah, every single filmmaker in. So yeah. All the films this weekend, you can expect to talk to somebody involved with the film.
Yeah, Martha, so you'll be doing a talk back after your screening tonight.
I will, with Tim and our actor Brian, who plays Lyman, who's
Brian.
Supporting. Yeah. Great. So we'll be talking it up. And then afterwards, we have a party at the Knock Bar at 11 o'clock.
Super.
So come.
All right, great. Thanks so much, guys. Thanks a lot. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks to Martha Stevens and Tim Morton, and good luck with Pilgrim's Song. The film will be screened at the Flyover Film Festival here in Louisville. That's all the time we have for today's program. Byline is produced by the WFPL news staff, a production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. Joe Durso provides technical support. I'm Rick Heldet. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.